Good morning. It is Sunday, September 1st, 2013. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
I'm Kyle Kellums. The Jazz Eureka 2013 Festival begins Friday, September 13th, and will run through Sunday the 15th. This three-day event will include both free and ticketed events. Performers include the Fayetteville Jazz Collective, Walter Savage Trio, and recording artist Spyro Gyra. Information is available on the web at eurekasprings.org.
Ahead on this morning's show, a rundown of theater as the area stages get ready for the autumn season. We'll also conclude our summer series on what the approaching Affordable Care Act means for Arkansas with a report on a little-known provision that provides for long-term care in the home.
But before we look ahead, a quick look back as Ozarks at Large's Timothy Dennis has this morning's Week in Review, a week filled with news about education and schools.
On Friday, we brought you a report about new enrollment totals at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville and how this year looks to be another record year in the number of students on campus. Though the total enrollment won't be official until the 11th day of classes, Chancellor G. David Gearhart announced preliminary enrollment numbers for this school year.
I'm very pleased to announce that this year's enrollment number confirms that we are still doing things right. And it's my pleasure to announce to you that we have, as of today, 25,365 students.
That's an increase over last year's enrollment of 24,537 students and an increase of more than 6,000 students since 2008, or a growth rate of about 32%. This is the first time that enrollment has topped 25,000 students at the nearly 150-year-old campus. Provost Sharon Gaber says that not only is the milestone significant by the sheer numbers, but it surpasses previous goals set by the university.
Only a few years ago, we had a long-range goal of reaching 25,000 students by 2021, the year of our sesquicentennial. We thought it would be tough, it would be ambitious, and if we worked hard, we could reach it. Needless to say, while we wanted and we planned to grow, it happened a little faster than we expected.
Considering the pace at which enrollment has grown and taking into account the goal of 25,000 students by 2021 has been exceeded, Provost Gaber says that the new goal is to stabilize enrollment at around 28,000 students in the next few years. But that number isn't necessarily a hard and fast enrollment cap.
We will certainly assess once we get there. I think there's a number of factors that would suggest that that's really where our infrastructure can handle. But then we'll want to look. We know that that's still below the SEC average. So we want to look. We want to remain competitive in the U.S. and internationally. We want to remain competitive in the SEC. So I think for us, it's we'll get to 28,000. We'll look and see what we have in place and what we can do. We may want to stay there. We may want to continue to move forward.
But the University of Arkansas isn't the only school poised for continued growth. Less than a month after opening, the Rogers School District is already looking to expand the Rogers New Tech High School. Jim White, the chief operating officer for Rogers Public Schools, says that while the architects haven't even begun designing phase two of New Tech High, district administrators have a good idea of what will be built in the roughly 5,000 square foot expansion.
It would mainly include two things, of course, classroom and some administrative space and probably some additional parking. We need to understand that this is taking place in our annex building that is actually a former middle school. That's why we had to go in and do the phase one was simply a remodel of some existing middle school space to accommodate high school classes. And that's what we did. And now that we have these 300 in our core area, our place to feed the kids and have some meetings, now we need to add some really mainly classroom space.
White says that the school district is already considering the expansion to the new school as they feel that the space will soon be needed.
We're starting only with these younger grades, only 9th and 10th graders. So next year, as these 10th graders move up to 11th, you don't have a new group of 9th graders come in, and then the next year after that. We filled our 300. We could only take 300. The kids are very excited about the program, and we feel like we're not going to have any problem getting to 600. It's certainly our hope.
Though the school district was denied state partnership money to build out the expansion, White says that the school district has enough money in its building fund to complete the project by the beginning of the next school year. But stories of growth and expansion weren't the only school news we brought you this week on Ozarks. Late in the week, we told you that the Springdale School District is educating students about potential dangers associated with social media. Rick Schaefer, the district's communications director, says that the information is being taught to students by the district's library media specialists.
The reason that you have it in your curriculum is because social media is one of the biggest things in America and actually the world today. There's 1.1 billion users of Facebook, so we would be remiss if we didn't address that with our students since most of them use it. And social media can be one of the best things out there, or if it's misused, it can be very dangerous. And so you've got to caution them about the dangers so that our students will be using it for the right reason.
Schaefer says that the library staff covers a range of topics to help keep students safe online.
I think they caution you about knowing who you're talking to. You know, how many instances have we seen of young people getting involved on social media with people that were disguising their identity? They caution you about that. Certainly caution you about posts you make. Don't do anything in anger. You know, because you think about it, anything that goes out there, you may think you're just between you and somebody else, but it's out there in cyberspace for everybody. So, you know, just to be cautious of what you're doing and not to give too much personal information because you never know who might be looking at it.
He says that in addition to the information taught by the district's media specialists, officers from the Springdale Police Department have held special sessions at the district's middle and junior high schools in order to give students some real-life examples of some of the dangers of being too open online. From the Harold and Blanche Kalk News Studio, I'm Timothy Dennis, and this is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
To end our summer series on the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act in Arkansas, we examine a little-known aspect of the law that will greatly expand opportunities for thousands of Arkansans requiring long-term health care to receive help, not in an institution, but at home. The initiative is called Community First Choice Option, and Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich has this report.
Under the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act of 2010, disabled and elder Medicaid beneficiaries who require institutional care will be offered an alternative option.
In the very basic sense, the Community First Choice Option will provide home and community-based services to individuals who, without the services, would have to enter a nursing home or other institutional setting and would not be able to reside independently in the community.
Anna Makagovina is Assistant Director of Policy and Planning for the Division of Developmental Disability Services at the Arkansas Department of Human Services in Little Rock. The Community First Choice aims to help elder, disabled, behavioral, and developmentally challenged Arkansans who meet certain financial and medical eligibility criteria to move back to their family of origin or into their own homes, where they will receive appropriate care.
Yes, transitional services from an institutional setting based back to the community for individuals is an optional service that states may choose to provide under Community First Choice. And basically what it covers for those individuals that choose to move back into community, it will cover basically cost of reestablishing a household in the community, such as first month's rent or deposit, basic supplies for your kitchen or furnishings, so that those individuals that have lost that household in the community can reestablish that residence and can move back into a more integrated setting.
Right now in Arkansas, DHS serves 4,200 with intellectual disabilities, 2,000 physically disabled people, and 6,000 enrolled in Elder Choices Care. The program will also pay for community-based attendant services and support systems.
Well, major categories of services that are provided under Community First Choice are basically services that would enable individuals to reside independently. For example, personal activities such as bathing, eating, grooming, getting dressed, things that people need assistance in taking care of themselves. Also, assistance with activities that are typical for somebody who needs to be able to live independently in community, such as shopping for food or clothes, moving in the community, getting to the grocery store, doing household chores and activities. And also, it pays for the items, the Community for Choice program pays for the items that increase in dependence, for example, home modifications. So instead of somebody coming in and helping a person into a bathtub, modifying the bathroom so that person can walk into a shower instead without assistance. So items that replace a human assistance by providing modifications to the home or adaptive equipment type services.
Arkansas is among a half dozen states which have applied to implement the program.
When they released the final guidance in the spring of last year, they issued a new rule where eligibility criteria for Community First Choice would require a person to meet institutional level of care need. And at that point, we started doing financial analysis of the feasibility of this program, because this program actually provides an enhanced financial federal funding for these services. And we realized that by implementing this program, we would no longer be able to have waiting lists or any caps on the service. So what we had to determine is that the enhanced federal financial participation should be sufficient to cover the services to the additional individuals who would enter this program. And at that point, we've done financial analysis and determined that basically, due to enhanced federal funding, this program would be basically financially neutral to the state because of the funding. And at that point, we decided to proceed with developing and implementing the program.
A wide range of Arkansans will be eligible to enroll in CFCO.
To be eligible for this program, an individual needs to be already Medicaid eligible. So Community First Choice does not create a new eligibility category for Medicaid. So individual has to be already Medicaid eligible, so one of the existing categories, and they have to meet institutional level of care need requirement, and obviously have the need for the types of services that CFCO would provide.
And how many will be allowed to participate?
Well, since today we serve population that covers individuals with intellectual disabilities, physically disabled, and people with age-related disabilities, basically those individuals that receive those services today through our waiver programs will be transitioned to Community First Choice option. Additionally, we are looking at starting to enroll our Alternative Community Services waiver waitlist into the program, and we anticipate to start enrolling those individuals July 1st of next year and continue to enroll those individuals over the course of the year. And July 1st of 2014 is our anticipated implementation date for this program, obviously pending CMS approval.
An estimated 2,600 Arkansans are currently on the wait list. So far, two states, California and Oregon, have applied and been granted CFCO status. Arkansas Department of Human Services is submitting its plan in the coming weeks, which was developed by an advisory council of 18 stakeholders.
Yes. To implement the Community First Choice option, states are required to convene a council of stakeholders. And what's remarkable about this one is that federal government specifically required the states to ensure that the majority of the participants in the council were consumers and individuals with disabilities. We had a council of 18 individuals, majority of which represented different groups of individuals that we serve, as well as providers and advocacy groups.
Several years ago, we reported on a similar test project that had been implemented in Arkansas called the Money Follows the Person Demonstration Project to transition institutionalized individuals back to their communities. That program will end in 2016, replaced by Community First Choice. And Anna Makagovina understands firsthand the value of such initiatives.
My sister has a developmental disability, and so our entire family have gone through basically all possible life experiences that a family with an individual with a developmental disability can have. And so I'm also able to draw a lot from that experience and firsthand knowledge of challenges that these families deal with on an everyday basis.
When the Community First Choice program was introduced last April, U.S. Secretary of Health and Human Services Kathleen Sebelius said that prior to passage of the Affordable Care Act, families with disabled loved ones had few choices beyond nursing homes or institutions. But programs like Community First Choice aim to change that. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
We'll continue to have coverage on Ozarks at Large of the effects of the various parts of the Affordable Care Act as the act is rolled out over the next few months and into 2014.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. In a memo to company directors this week, a human resources executive for Walmart, the world's largest retailer, announced that the company will offer comprehensive health care coverage to registered domestic partners and legally married same-sex couples starting next year. 10 years ago, Walmart expanded its non-discrimination policy to include sexual orientation. In 2005, established an internal pride resource group at the home office, and in recent years, extended non-discrimination to include gender expression, gender identity, and even intersex individuals. But for years, the company did not convey same-sex or domestic partnership benefits. Beginning next year, however, Walmart will provide coverage to all 1.3 million U.S. workers who have same or opposite sex domestic registered partners, as well as to legally married same-sex couples. The decision, the memo said, was based in part on the U.S. Supreme Court's decision to strike down Section 3 of the 1996 Defense of Marriage Act, leaving it up to states to decide. Randy Hargrove is a spokesman with Walmart.
Each of the states are developing different definitions of marriage, domestic partners, civil unions. So by developing a single definition for all of our associates, we believe we can give them the consistency across the markets that we operate.
The memorandum also warned about potential adverse reaction, urging executives and managers to be supportive of multiple viewpoints in conveying the news to associates, saying the decision was based on business rather than morals or politics.
One of our tenets as an employer is respect for the individual. And, you know, this, just falling in line, with what we practice as a company every day.
The memo further stated that given an increasingly diverse culture, a comprehensive benefit package that includes domestic partner and same-sex benefits will appeal to what the memo describes as a contemporary workforce. Of 30 retail competitors, all but two provide either same or opposite sex domestic partnership coverage, the memo pointed out. According to the gay civil rights advocacy group, the Human Rights Campaign, 62% of Fortune 500 companies now provide domestic partnership health insurance benefits to their employees.
Later today on This American Life, little kids on a long car trip.
I did not sing. He's lying. He lies all the time.
Students being dropped off at college.
I had everybody in the car crying my first time.
A bachelorette party.
The only thing I know is that I need flip-flops, a whistle, and something else.
And everything else that happens at a rest stop on the side of the highway.
And suddenly, a clown truck filled with clowns cut us off.
Later today.
This American Life with Ira Glass at 10 this morning on KUAF 91.3 FM. Thursday, on our daily edition of Ozarks, we aired a story about the phenomenal growth of club sports on the University of Arkansas campus. Bowling, ballroom dancing, cricket, and lacrosse are just a few of the 30 club sports on the U of A campus. And more could be added soon. Student-led groups are trying to get sports like golf, badminton, and water polo qualified. This summer, I talked to Luke Phillips and Patrick Garcia, a sophomore and freshman respectively at the U of A, about their work to create a Razorback water polo team. Both played high school water polo in Texas, but of course, Arkansas's relationship with the sport is minimal. I mentioned to Luke that few games, other than the Summer Olympics, are even seen on TV channels in Arkansas outside the sports packages high up on a cable or satellite package.
That's true. It's becoming more popular, though. I've noticed it, like, they'll be on a major network every now and then, and there'll be a tournament here or whatever, and the men's national team is actually, men and women's national teams have both been doing amazingly well these last few years. And that's really helping draw a lot of attention to the sport. But like I said, it's really popular on the coast, the West Coast, and then it's even a little less popular on the East Coast, but more popular so than it is in the central areas like Texas up to Arkansas and so on. But they're growing the sport, and it's really exciting to see just in the last few years since I've been playing how much it has grown, and I'm hoping to really be a part of that growth.
It's a great spectator sport.
Oh, definitely. Yeah.
It's an exciting.
So fun to watch. I'll have friends come over and watch games whenever I was back home, and they would just be like, man, that's so intense. You know, I may not have understood what was going on, but the basic concept of the game is pretty easy to get. But they were just like, wow, that was really intense sport.
And, you know, one of the complaints you hear about Americans who don't like soccer is that there's not enough offense. That's not a problem in water polo.
No, the ball is constantly changing sides. Like, there's no, like, there's a 30-second shot clock or 30-second shot clock, and there's constantly fouls being called, something going on where the ball will change possession. So there's good amount of offense and defense, and then there's a lot of wrestling in the water as well. I mean, it's a ruthless game, but it's a ton of fun.
You're treading water the whole time you're in there, right?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
How do you do that? Seriously, how do you do that?
We got jets on the bottom of our feet.
It looks like it at times. But,
like he said, swimming helps you a lot because you're always moving your feet. But when you get in the water, it's more of repetition instead of just getting in the water and doing it. If you do segments, like we had in practice, we do at times, like three during middle drills, he'll stop and we'll do 3 minutes of, you know, it's called egg beater. And we do that for 2 or 3 minutes straight just to get repetition in.
It's a type of kick. Once you learn it and get it down and practice it, it's kind of like a dog swimming in water. You know, they do the doggy paddle. It's just as comfortable for a water polo player to do the egg beater kick, like, once it's done. Even my dad, who, I mean, he's old and out of shape now, but he said, like, you know, I'll jump in the water now and I can do egg beater kick and I'll be able to tread water forever still. Like, wow. It's just something that once you do it and do it enough repetition, it just starts coming naturally. Like, I would say after my first week of practices, like, the first practice I was beat down, tired. I was just like, how do you do that for so long? But then after the first week or so, I was just like, okay, I'm starting to get it. This is cool.
Yeah.
If it all gets together, the paperwork, the team, the constitution, the funds, when would you – perfect world, when would we first have a Razorback water polo event?
The pool is set up for water polo. We actually have goals, and we just need a little help getting some other equipment, the caps and balls. But they actually have goals there right now. The pool is ready for water polo games. So it's just a matter of getting everything lined up and then – I'll probably start out with an RSO, just something just to see how much we get.
And that's a registered student organization.
Right. And it might not be as competitive as I would like it to be right off the bat, but just to see how we would stack up and how good the team would be. And then eventually I'd like to sign up with the CWPA, or Collegiate Water Polo Association. And there's different regions that we can join. We'll probably go with either Missouri Valley area or the Southwest region.
Do you think you'd be able to field a team right from the get-go that has experience?
Definitely. I went to Rock Camp freshman year right off the bat, and I saw a guy wearing a USA Water Polo shirt. He actually ended up being from Missouri. I need to find him again and get him recruited. So now that I'm actually going to do this. So there's all sorts of people out there who either know about it, used to play, or have the willingness to go with it. And actually, I've done some talking with the club swimming leader, his name is Lucas, and he was like, yeah, I've got a bunch of guys who would love to come play if you get this actually working.
Luke Phillips and Patrick Garcia are trying to start a University of Arkansas water polo club sport team. I talked to them earlier this summer. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large.
With an appeal to be heard next month, the superintendents of two Arkansas school districts are defending programs to arm teachers and staff. This week, a legislative committee heard arguments about whether having guns on campus is the best way to protect students. Michael Hiblin, with our content partner KUAR, attended the hearing and has this report.
Lake Hamilton Superintendent Steve Anderson told members of the Joint Judiciary Committee that in addition to two full-time armed security officers, his district has had several staff members, including himself, who have quick access to firearms if the need arises.
We are not law enforcement officers, and we realize that. We're not a SWAT team. We're not Navy SEALs. We're not John Waynes or Rambos, but we're a long way from Barney Fife also.
He said it's the unfortunate reality after a string of school shootings nationwide.
I've heard critics that have made the contention that your public school, you shouldn't have guns there. I totally agree. We shouldn't. But the times that we live in have required us to do things a lot differently.
Anderson said the program has been in place for 20 years in Lake Hamilton schools, and they've never had any problems. None of those involved are teachers, but school staff trained to respond if someone comes into a school with a weapon.
While others are taking care of their children, whether they're in a lockdown situation or they're evacuating the building, they're going to take care of their kids. But there's a few of us that instead of running away from the threat, will run toward it. I just feel like we need the tools required to protect our kids, to protect our staff, and to protect ourselves.
But after a recent opinion from Attorney General Dustin McDaniel, a state panel suspended licenses issued under a little-known law that allowed school staff to be licensed as private security guards. Clarksville Superintendent David Hopkins told lawmakers he disagreed with that.
If someone is coming in to hurt my kids, I want to be able to do something rather than ball up and get in the fetal position in the corner. I want to fight. I want to fight for my kids. And if that means me being a little bit uncomfortable by having to carry a gun from day to day, I'll accept that.
His district has trained 22 teachers and staff members. But Brenda Robinson, president of the Arkansas Education Association, argued against having teachers with guns in the classroom, though she acknowledged there are vulnerabilities.
I taught in middle school last year, and we have three little slots. And I always said, well, someone can always take us out in the C building because we're right there by ourselves. Anything can happen at any day, at any given moment. And I know we have to be there to protect our children, but arming educators, I don't think, is the best plan. And I'm not saying taking away any district's authority of having any plan, secure plan, safety plan. I'm all for that. But I just don't think that arming educators is the best solution.
In 2 weeks, the Arkansas Board of Private Investigators and private security agencies will hear an appeal of its decision involving 13 districts. State Senator Jeremy Hutchinson said the legislature is considering making changes to state law, possibly during next year's fiscal session.
I think a lot's going to depend on what the board does when they come back up for the September meeting as to whether or not they revoke those licenses or reinstate them. If they reinstate them, it may not be as urgent an issue because there at least will be some mechanism by which they can have armed personnel.
Hutchinson, a Republican from Benton, said he wants each school board to make up its own mind and create a program with input from parents. He said lawmakers are also considering steps to keep the names of school personnel involved a secret.
We already have exemptions, FOI, for all sorts of security reasons, and I can't think of any reason why that wouldn't be included. You don't want somebody planning an attack to be able to send an FOI request and find out exactly Mrs. Smith in room 304 is armed, and you know the principal, I need to take him out first.
Depending on what happens in the weeks ahead, Hutchinson said additional legislative hearings may be held. In Little Rock, I'm Michael Heplin.
As Northwest Arkansas and the rest of our population grow, we humans tend to spread out. The lines of city limits are often pushed out, with development sprawling beyond. As a result, human and animal interactions are increasing, especially the number of deer we see crossing roads, hanging out in our lawns and gardens, and hiding in our trees. In an attempt to deal with the wildlife-human conflict, the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission created a new position, Urban Wildlife Biologist. I recently spoke with Mark E. Hutchings, who was hired for this new position earlier this year. In particular, we spoke about the deer population. Hutchings says that much of what we do in terms of development actually provides a good habitat for deer.
We try to protect, you know, watersheds by leaving vegetative buffers, you know, along creek sides and stream sides. And we try to leave some greenways just from the aesthetic side of things. And so much of that habitat, you know, is pretty attractive to wildlife. And along with that, as the housing developments go in, many times those housing developments are developed in a way where it creates a lot of good edge. There's a lot of landscaping that's done, and a lot of those flowering plants are quite attractive to deer and other critters.
He says there are plants that are less attractive to deer than others. My mom has given up on hostas. Hutchings says it isn't 100% foolproof, though. In a drought year like last year, they'll come into our watered yards and eat what they can find.
Deer are pretty much browsers. They like the broadleaf plants, flowering plants, the vines. Many of the vegetable gardens are prime candidates for, you know, deer. So in instances where you are gardening, if it's possible, fencing those is probably the best option. There are a lot of products on the market in terms of repellents and those types of things, and they have mixed reviews. I talk with some people that have pretty good success with them, and I talk to other people that really don't have a great deal of success with them.
Sometimes they'll work for a period of time and then no longer work. Other options to deter deer from yards and plants are motion-activated water sprinklers, lights, plain old fences, or dogs. But is there some sort of happy medium for those of us that enjoy looking at deer, but not so much losing the plants?
Not everyone has the same opinion. Some people will tolerate them to a greater level than others. And that's where we get into situations where we get called. Whenever someone has reached kind of the end of their limit, where they've had enough damage to landscape plants or garden plants, that sort of thing, oftentimes we'll get a call and they want some help in doing something about it. It depends on the culture of the folks that are dealing with those. Some people, like I say, will tolerate much more, and others, you know, have a shorter string and won't tolerate them quite as much. That's what makes it difficult to manage sometimes as well.
He says deer and other animals have adapted so much that their populations are actually growing, hence the increased sightings, even in the older neighborhoods.
Part of that is because several years ago, probably there were far fewer developed acres in town, and as we continue to grow and build more and develop more, we crowd those animals down into smaller corridors, and in some instances, they just become more visible. Numbers maybe have increased, but at the same time, not necessarily to a great degree, but maybe they're just more visible to us than they once were.
Not only more visible, but also more tolerable. Deer tend to not run away from cars and people as often or as quickly as they once did, as they become more adapted to an urban environment.
Where there's a lot of activity, a lot of people, they see them on a daily basis, and so they've become a little less fearful. They're not being pursued from a hunting standpoint. So, you know, other than some deer vehicle collisions occasionally, they're really not being harassed a whole lot.
Living in this urban environment, Hutchings says, could actually increase the lifespan of a deer due to the readily available vegetation for feeding and lack of hunting. Longer lifespan equals more procreation.
Once a doe reaches sexual maturity, which really happens after the first year, the first time she has a fawn, she's probably going to have one. But subsequent years after that, if she's healthy and food, you know, availability is there and she have good habitat, they're going to oftentimes have twins. Sometimes does will have triplets. So, you know, their ability to reproduce is pretty good. And so we can see some numbers, you know, increase over time with good habitat conditions and good health in the herd.
Because of this increased in-town deer population, the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission offers municipalities the option to apply for an urban archery deer hunt program, with 7 cities in Arkansas currently taking part, including Fort Smith, which will begin in September.
It's a pretty good program, and it helps us to work with some of the cities to at least reduce some of the numbers within city boundaries. They're able to kind of identify the areas where they would allow the hunting opportunity to occur. They can identify how large of a scale they want to try to tackle, and so that, you know, the permit numbers are adjusted accordingly to that.
Numbers show the important role that hunting plays in the deer population. Hutchings says that in the 1920s, Arkansas had about 500 white-tailed deer due to over-harvesting by market hunters. As a result of conservation and regulations, today, the population is estimated at around 1 million.
We can harvest to the point where we can almost do them in, as we did back in the 20s, or we can, you know, we can step back from that and harvest at a limited level and see a good, healthy deer herd statewide. So hunting does play a big part. So I think that's something that we need to consider as we move forward with looking at reduction in numbers, you know, in some of these areas where we have some overpopulation problems.
Mark Hutchings is an urban wildlife biologist with the Arkansas Game and Fish Commission.
If you want to get really good at remembering things,
43, okay.
Here's the trick.
27. Okay. Create wild, outlandish, and therefore memorable images in your mind's eye. A ram bouncing into my parents' front door, which is 43.
Oh, you missed 11.
Oh!
Yeah.
It was pornographic.
The mystery of memory. That's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
The TED Radio Hour, today at noon on KUAF 91.3 FM.
Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for the first day of September 2013. I'm Christina Thomas.
And I'm Kyle Kellums.
Joining us now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Happy day.
First day of September, huh?
Yeah, lots of memories about this day. Let's talk about The Nerd at the Art Center of the Ozarks.
Okay.
One of my favorite plays. Here's the premise. A guy named Rick Steadman shows up at a dinner party. He's dressed wildly inappropriately.
Like a nerd?
Beyond that.
Okay.
He throws the dinner guest's shoes out the window. He sings and plays patriotic songs on the tambourine to put himself to sleep. And he ruins his host's architectural plans for a pricey hotel by drawing on them. And he does it all without knowing he's committed a single social gaffe.
No clue.
Or maybe he does.
Oh.
The premise of The Nerd, which is opening next weekend at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale, is that Rick Steadman saved the life of his host, Willem, in the war. Mm-hmm. They've never met. And so Willem thinks that's who this is. And well, you can't throw him out, and you can't be mean to him because he saved your life.
Yeah, that's a big debt.
Yes, that's a big debt. Or he could drive you insane and you kill him and leave the body in the closet. The trick to the whole all of this is that these are stereotypical characters, and the comedy is really broad. Harry Blundell, the director of theater, compares it to Commedia. But you see a little bit of yourself or a little bit of your friends in all the characters, and you will laugh until you fall on the floor. The first time I saw the show, my daughter was a baby, or maybe didn't even exist yet, and she spent her whole life hearing shoes and socks.
Yeah, that's a
lot. You'll understand when you see it. Show starts September 6th at the Art Center of the Ozarks, runs for 2 weekends, and tickets are $20 for non-member adults at 751-5441. Also going on today, the Prairie Grove Clothesline Fair
continues
in its second day at Prairie Grove Battlefield State Park west of Fayetteville.
I went yesterday.
It's a big tradition for you, is it not?
It is. It is.
My family. I'll be there Monday.
Yeah, my family goes every Saturday morning.
Really?
We have to be there pretty much at 8:30.
Oh, my.
Great Aunt Monica, yep.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my.
Oh, yeah.
So what do you look for when you go?
I look for the heads of my mom and my great aunt Monica and my cousin.
To make sure you're not lost.
Yeah.
Okay, then. I'm not going to look for that because that would be creepy.
I like the pottery. I do.
I do, too. Yeah. It'll be fun. I'm going tomorrow. Hours are 8:30 to 5 today, and you need a $5 bill or five ones for parking. The Crawford County Chronicles. This afternoon at the Drennan Scott Historic Site in Van Buren. That's at 2 o'clock. Talking about the archaeology of Crawford County. You better call.
Yeah.
They've been selling out. Or not selling out. It's free. But they've been filling up.
Yes.
262-2750. There's an ice cream social from 2 to 4 at the Fort Smith Museum of History. $5 for ice cream. And the band Perry performs tonight at 8 o'clock at Downstream Casino west of Joplin. Tickets start at $40 at downstreamcasino.com.
Thank you, Becca.
Becca Martin Brown is features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large, and it is time for our Sunday montage.
It is.
This is Labor Day.
Right.
And you would think maybe inspired by work, but we did that last year, And Timothy Dennis has a special Labor Day montage on tomorrow's edition of Daily Ozarks.
Which is officially Labor Day.
Which is officially Labor Day. So, instead, did you know it was on this day in 1897 that the first subway in the United States began operation?
I did not.
Do you know what city that was in?
I mean, my guess is New York.
That's what I would have guessed. But no, it was the Boston MTA.
Well, there you go.
Opened on this day in 1897. So here are 10 clips dedicated to pop culture and the subway.
Trains in the 40s. Those days a man would give up his seat for a woman. Now we're liberated, we have to stay in.
It's ironic.
What's ironic?
This, that we've come all this way, we made all this progress, but, you know, we lost the little things, the niceties.
No, I mean, what does ironic mean?
There's no way you can get away with this. You are underground in a tunnel.
At precisely 3:13, we are going to begin executing the hostages.
Metropolitan Transit Authority, better known as the MTA, is attempting to levy a burdensome tax on the population in the form of a subway fare increase. Citizens, hear me out. This could happen to you.
Well, let me tell you of the story of a man named Charlie on that tragic and fateful day. He put 10 cents in his pocket while the family went to ride on the MTA.
But did he ever return? No, he never returned.
I did. But I just felt so sorry for the creature at the end.
Sorry for the creature? Why'd you want him to marry the girl?
He was kind of scary looking, but he wasn't really all bad. I think he just craved a little affection, you know, a sense of being loved and needed and wanted.
That's a very interesting point of view.
Oh, do you feel the breeze from the subway? Isn't it delicious?
You hear that, Mr. Anderson? That is the sound of inevitability. It is the sound of your death. Goodbye, Mr. Anderson.
My name is Neo.
Excuse me.
What's it, lady?
Pardon me, Sonny.
Down below the street, and you did your steady beat. It's a subway.
Subway!
Moving right along, hear the rhythm loud and strong. It's the subway.
Subway!
And there isn't any room in this town.
They put all the trains down under the ground.
Buy a token now for a ride in Super Wow on the subway.
If you'd like to see what all of those clips are, who you heard singing, what movies and television shows you heard snippets from, you can go to our webpage, ozarksatlarge.com.
And just a few minutes ago, Becca Martin Brown told us a little bit about theater happening.
Yes, it's not that theater goes away around here in the summer. You have the summer musicals at ACO and Rogers Little Theater. Fort Smith Little Theater did some things, but boy, it's about to go full bore. The Spiritualist started already Thursday night. And as is our custom, this time every month, we take an overview of drama, and Antoinette Grajeda handled the duties for us this month.
Students throughout the area are back in school, which means we're getting closer to fall, a season full of live theater. Next Wednesday, New Orleans performance artist Jose Torres Tama will perform his one-person show, Aliens, Immigrants, and Other Evildoers, at 7:30 p.m. in Hillside Auditorium on the University of Arkansas campus. In honor of Hispanic Heritage Month, the piece is underwritten by the university's Artists and Concerts Series, the Department of Drama, and the Center for Diversity and Multicultural Education. Admission is free. Rogers Little Theater will kick off its run of The Wizard of Oz September 13th. The Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale will produce not one, but two shows next month. Performances of The Nerd have been scheduled for September 6th through the 8th and September 13th and 14th. Later in the month, you can catch Cinderella at the ACO September 28th and 29th. In addition to a production of The Neverending Story, September 12th through the 15th, Arts Life Theater Executive Director Mark Landon Smith says they are preparing for fall classes, which begin the week of September 9th.
We've got a great, great slate of fall classes coming up. We've got musical theater. We're doing The Music of Annie, the music of Beauty and the Beast musical theater. We've got comedy improv. We've got ALT TV, which is a new thing we're launching. It's a television program that's going to highlight theater throughout the region, but it's all going to be produced by our young students. And we've got auditions coming up for Zombie High School Homecoming, which has been written by one of our students, Reed C. Carson. And then we've got opening on September 12th, we've got The Neverending Story. And then we also got auditions coming up for Disney's Alice in Wonderland, the musical. That's happening in September also. So we've got a lot going on at ALT.
While Mark often teaches aspiring young actors, in September, he himself will be performing in the Classical Edges production of Julius Caesar.
And then we're going to take scenes that still need work and go outside after we do the run-through. All right? Okay. Places, everyone.
Last week, members of the Classical Edge gathered inside a classroom in Kimple Hall on the University of Arkansas campus to rehearse its upcoming Shakespeare in the Park production. Justin Schauer, the group's artistic director, says the Classical Edge is a small professional company devoted to doing only the classics in a contemporary, fun way. For the past 5 years, Justin and his wife, Virginia, have participated in Shakespeare in the Park productions throughout Northwest Arkansas. This is the second year they will be doing so as the Classical Edge, and the first year they will be performing in Bentonville. Justin explains this is the first time they are co-producing the event with the Bentonville Parks and Recreation Department. Justin says the collaboration started when he approached the group about performing in a Bentonville park.
And then David Wright, who is the head of the department, wrote back and said, hey, let's meet. And then he wanted to take it to the next level possibly. You know, we'll see how this year goes and we'll see how they feel about this production. But he said that it seemed to really fit with their mission of, you know, they have wonderful programming and they have education and they have sports and they have play, but, you know, this is going to help with that part of the mission that's about culture. And so he said he reached out to some of the people in the community and they seemed also very excited about having Shakespeare in Bentonville. And we've talked about this before, that Shakespeare in the Park tends to be sort of a badge of health for a city. Like if they have Shakespeare in the Park, they are kind of up and coming and they're culturally aware. And so I think Bentonville is a perfect place for that.
In addition to public performances, Justin says the Classical Edge is taking a program to 5 different high schools in the area.
There's going to be a workshop, a Common Core workshop, to front load the play and then the performance. And so I think that element of this will probably be something that we'll explore in the future, and I don't think that would be in conflict with anybody else's sort of mission or design. So,
right, we call it education. And so, I mean, traveling around is great because it gives other people the opportunity to experience Shakespeare. And so we do not want to lose that aspect of touring around and traveling to schools and educating them.
And this production is going to include several high school students in the production in Bentonville, and then in the schools we will be including as many kids as are interested, and it's going to be kind of a breaking the fourth wall and integrative, and it's exciting.
Justin says students will be able to participate in a mob scene, and a few will even have small roles during the school program. 10th graders often study Julius Caesar, so that was one reason this specific play was selected for this year's Shakespeare in the Park.
There was interest in finding a way to merge Common Core with performance and to have some sort of outreach element for our company. And so Julius Caesar was a natural fit because almost every school reads that, and we could connect with sophomores so they're young enough to get kind of bitten by the Shakespeare bug. And so I think that was the main reason. And we all love the play, and I think we've grown to love it even more than we did originally. And it's a really fantastic piece to work on, but it was the educational aspect that was the impetus for that.
Mm-hmm. I think we can all relate to it. It is done. We are doing it in the time period it was written for. And so it will have a traditional sense. But I think we can all relate to everything that is going on in Julius Caesar now. So come and make your own opinions about what Julius Caesar has to say for today.
During September, local residents can catch two performances of Julius Caesar in Bentonville and two performances in Fayetteville. However, Justin and Virginia both say one of their goals for the Classical Edge is to find a permanent home for Shakespeare in the Park.
We just haven't found the right place to like just stick to and call a home. We want somebody to say, hey, this is your home. Come every year.
Yeah. And Bentonville Parks and Rec have been the first organization to say, yes, we're not just going to allow you to do it in our space. We want to be a part of this, and we believe in your mission, and we believe in the potential, and also understand how this raises the cultural capital of our community. And we haven't had an organization do that yet. And
I think it's all about finding the right fit. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so many places and so many people doing different things. It's finding that right fit on who and where you can partner with people.
Yes. And we have found that the folks we've been working with at Bentonville Parks and Rec are extremely energetic, extremely positive, extremely engaged, and Lane Moore has been another really important contact for us, and she's been great in helping to get the word out. And
they've been doing a lot of publicity and marketing for us, which has been amazing. Yeah. To have that kind of support is just such a blessing.
The Classical Edge will perform Julius Caesar as its Shakespeare in the Park production this year. Free performances are scheduled for 6 p.m. September 7th and 2 p.m. September 8th at Lawrence Plaza in Bentonville. The company will also host performances at 2 p.m. September 15th and 22nd at Gully Park in Fayetteville. More information is available at theclassicaledge.org. For details on other theater happening during the month of September, visit ozarksatlarge.com.
Caesar, speak! Caesar, it's time to hear!
Beware the Ides of March!
What woman is that?
Soothsayer bids you beware the Ides of March.
Set her before me and let me see her face.
Lady, come from the throng. Look upon Caesar.
Now.
The AMP, Arkansas Music Pavilion, presents The Black Crows Wednesday, September 11th at 7:30 p.m. This American rock band, formed around the Robinson Brothers in 1989, and produced charting singles like Hard to Handle, She Talks to Angels, and more. Tickets and more information available at amptickets.com or by calling 443-5600.
This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Seligman, Missouri.
Seligman, Missouri.
Seligman, Missouri.
No subway there.
There might be a Subway sandwich shop. I don't know. but there's no, I guess geographically, the closest subway to us would be,
I don't know. That's a toughie.
You've got the L in Chicago.
I mean, it's not, it has to be a sub, underground.
Yeah, I don't know. Someone will tell us. Weekend Ozarks at Large, a production of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Thomas.
We'll be back with a special Labor Day show tomorrow at noon.